Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook. First on this week's program, Phoenix cops shoot, kill, suspected kidnapper from close range. This story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on February 27th. An armed kidnapping of a woman in West Phoenix ended in Gilbert just after midnight on February 12th when Phoenix police officers shot and killed 41-year-old David Garcia. Wednesday, the Phoenix Police Department released a critical incident briefing on the events that led to Garcia's death. The department's briefings are narrated by officers and made public after any police shooting or in-custody death. They typically include a limited selection of dispatch audio and body-worn camera footage. Phoenix police said Garcia fired at them when officers tried to stop his truck. The briefing shows police quickly emerging from multiple vehicles to fire at Garcia's truck from close range before breaking a window, opening the door, and pulling the woman from the passenger seat. The woman suffered a gunshot wound, but according to Gilbert Police, which is investigating the shooting, a Mesa ballistic exam showed the bullet fragments recovered from her were Garcia's weapon. Garcia was the second person shot and killed by Phoenix police this year, though another was shot and killed on February 19th. Another man died in police custody on January 10th. Phoenix police shot and killed 14 people last year, and 12 in 2023, both up from 10 in 2022. He has a gun. The briefing starts with audio from a 911 call on February 11th. At a hotel near 53rd Avenue and Interstate 10, a caller reported seeing Garcia forcing a woman into a car at gunpoint. "He has a gun. He has a gun," the caller tells the dispatcher in the clip. "He's trying to shoot her. He's pointing it at her as we speak." Garcia drove away, and officers later arrived on the scene to gather information. Department spokesperson Sergeant Brian Bowers said that officers from the department's neighborhood enforcement team located Garcia and the woman in Mesa several hours later. NET officers and officers from the Special Assignments Unit followed the truck as Garcia drove into Gilbert. Near the intersection of Higley and Williamsfield Road, police tried to immobilize the truck but failed. Police said Garcia made a U-turn and began shooting at officers, hitting one of the police cars. Footage from the attempt to stop Garcia's truck and of him shooting at police was not included in the briefing. However, one officer can be heard yelling, "He's shooting at us," as the officer exits his vehicle with a rifle. Neither Phoenix Police nor the Gilbert Police Department, which is investigating the shooting, has yet to release the names of the officers involved. After stopping the car, four officers quickly exited their vehicles and converged on Garcia's red pickup truck, firing at him from near point-blank range. They then broke the passenger side window and pulled out the woman, whose name has not been released. They found that she had a gunshot wound, which Mesa police determined was from Garcia's gun. The woman was taken to a hospital with severe injuries, but is now in stable condition and expected to survive, according to Gilbert Police spokesperson Brenda Carrasco. Garcia was also taken to a hospital where he died. The four officers who fired at Garcia have worked for Phoenix Police between 6 and 31 years, according to Bauer. Under investigation, Gilbert Police are currently investigating the incident. Despite the shooting happening outside of Phoenix city limits, no other agencies besides Phoenix Police were involved. After the investigation is complete, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office will review it, according to Carrasco. The incident occurred during a time of intense scrutiny on Phoenix Police. 8 months ago, the U.S. Department of Justice released a long-awaited report on Phoenix Police, which found that Phoenix Police have a pattern of using excessive and unjustified deadly force. Earlier this year, Video from another fatal police shooting showed an officer shooting and killing a man at long range while the man was running away. The officer claimed the man pointed a gun at him, but that isn't visible in the video shared by police. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHoux and posted on February 26th. The MAGA guy who handles voter rolls keeps spouting unprovable bullshit. Maricopa County Recorder and MAGA devotee Justin Heap is at war with the Republican-controlled County Board of Supervisors, and his arsenal is primarily stocked with bullshit. On Monday, Heap sent out a testy press release chronicling what he called his battle with the board over their respective election duties. At issue is a shared services agreement that splits election administrative duties between the board and the recorder's office. Heap doesn't like the current agreement, which he called radical. The former state legislator characterized it as a backroom 11th-hour power grab made by unpopular lame duck officials, that is, the previous iteration of the board, and former recorder Stephen Ricker, the moderate Republican whom Heap ousted in the primary, attempting to kneecap incoming elected officials, namely Heap. Quite the dramatic accusation. Too bad that, like many of Heap's public statements since taking office last month, it's at significant odds with the facts. For one, the SSA with the county wasn't quickly and secretly executed, as Heap suggested in his release. Its renegotiation was the subject of numerous news stories, and the agreement was discussed in public meetings. And while the timing was notable, Ricker was indeed a lame duck official, though Heap hadn't won the general election yet, the agreement didn't change nearly as much as Heap's release claimed. Heap's release correctly noted that the new agreement shifted a bunch of information technology staffers and $5 million in budget from the recorder's office to the board and moved some money. But Heap also claimed the agreement transferred nearly all the recorder's elections duties to the board, which isn't true. What really changed was that early ballot processing became the board's responsibility. In other words, the board's election staff will now open early ballot envelopes after the recorder's office has verified their signatures. It was a minor shift. Heap's chief of staff, Sam Stone, did not respond to questions from Phoenix New Times. In a statement, board chairperson Thomas Galvin, also a Republican, noted the factual errors in Heap's narrative. Journalist Garrett Archer, a former elections worker, called out the falsehood on social media, leading Ricker to chime in that one-third of the email is wrong. In an email to New Times, Ricker sardonically suggested that Heap deserves some slack. "This is Heap's first time with any employees," Ricker wrote. "So I think we should let the guy who struggled to file campaign finance reports, obtain car insurance, and who got fired by the county attorney's office crawl before he walks." A loose relationship with the truth. Ricker's acidic overview of Heap's record isn't off base. Heap was indeed fired by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office in 2010 and excluded thousands of dollars of political donations from campaign finance reports, though he was cleared of wrongdoing by the Arizona Attorney General's office. Since taking office, Heap's also shown a rather loose relationship with the truth. In January, Heap tooted his own horn for taking thousands of inactive voters off the voter rolls, when doing that was just a normal, statutorily mandated responsibility. Heap also announced a new policy to allow observers to be in the room where ballot envelope signatures get verified, even though that had already been happening. Earlier this month, Heap took credit for firing staffers that New Times subsequently reported had actually left on their own before he took office. It's come across as a ham-fisted attempt by Heap to conjure an image for himself as a tough guy here, to get Maricopa County's elections in line. During his run for recorder, Heap played up concerns about county elections, calling them a laughingstock on the campaign trail last year. He wants to restore authority to his office, he said in his press release. He warned of costly legal battles if the board didn't meet his demands. If the board is not even willing to enter into a good faith discussion with the recorder of the county, who is the primary elections officer, then maybe we do need to talk about it being consolidated back into this office, Heap said in a Monday interview with Fox 10. As it stands right now, the board is not taking the steps that I would expect and would be appropriate. By contrast, Galvin said in his statement that conversations between the board and its staff and the recorder and his staff have been happening for weeks. Heap's negotiating tactics certainly seem cribbed from the Donald Trump school of fact-free blustering. Ricker said that he had plenty of disagreements with the board while he was recorder, but he always handled those internally and not through the press. I certainly never publicly threatened to sue the board, Ricker said in an email. I think this evinces a pretty clear difference in personality types. There are people who work to get stuff done, and there are people who just like fighting. You can get away with the latter personality type when you're in the state legislature, city council, or the Congress, and you're not actually responsible for anything other than your own vote. What happens now remains to be seen. Heap claimed he terminated the agreement after consulting with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Stone told KJZZ that civil attorneys Thomas Liddy and Joseph LaRue from the county attorney's office offered their advice. Jeanine LeCour, the chief of staff for the county attorney's office, told the New Times that Liddy and LaRue provide legal advice to all MCAO agencies, including the board and the recorder's office. But she cannot disclose the content of any discussion. The Board of Supervisors isn't so sure that Heap can unilaterally cancel the agreement. Jason Berry, interim director of communications for Maricopa County, told New Times that the board is reviewing its legal options. LeCour said both the board and the recorder made the decision to work with outside counsel on the SSA matter only. Two lawmakers to speak at event for people who think aliens run politics. This next story was written by Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror and was posted on the New Times website on February 25th. Two Republican state lawmakers are set to speak at a convention for a fringe conspiracy theory that claims extraterrestrials are helping shape national and global policy. Senator Mark Finchem, Republican Prescott, and Representative Leo Biasiucci, Republican Lake Havasu, are listed as speakers at Quantum Summit 2, which will take place March 8th and 9th in Cape Canaveral, Florida. The event is being put on by a group of individuals who believe in the NESARA/GESARA conspiracy theory. In its most basic form, it's a conspiracy theory that revolves around a proposed piece of economic reforms from the 1990s called the National Economic Security and Recovery Act that conspiracy theorists believe was enacted in secret by President Bill Clinton but was covered up by the U.S. Supreme Court via a gag order and suppressed by the 9/11 attacks, which were orchestrated by George W. Bush. GESARA refers to a supposed global version of the economic reforms that adherents similarly believe was instituted and then hidden. In the early 2000s, the conspiracy theory gained popularity in the early internet days as Shaini Goodwin, calling herself the Dove of Oneness, made bold predictions about NESARA and world events, with dubious claims of insider knowledge. Goodwin is a graduate of a New Age school, whose leader often goes on homophobic and anti-Semitic rants, and has been teaming up with QAnon. It is also tied to the Nexium cult that was investigated for sex crimes and much more. The conspiracy theory has regained traction in recent years as QAnon adherents have flocked to it due to its many similarities. NESARA, GESARA, has often also been called the grandfather of the QAnon conspiracy movement. Goodwin initially promoted it as part of a larger scam that defrauded investors of millions of dollars with promises of the erasure of all debts and the eventual abolishment of the Internal Revenue Service. Believers also often claim that extraterrestrials have been in communication with them, or leaders within the movement, and are working to promote the NESARA-GESARA agenda. A promotional video for the Cape Canaveral event that Fincham and Biasiucci will speak at mentions discussions around encouraging the U.S. Space Force to work with the Galactic Federation. Fincham, Biasiucci, and Republican leadership in the State House of Representatives and Senate did not respond to requests for comment, including if they are aware of the beliefs of NESARA-GESARA. The topics to be covered at the summit include cryptocurrency, collaboration between Space Force and the Galactic Federation, flat Earth theories, the hidden realms of the inner Earth, Antarctica's mysteries and strategic importance, transforming the United States food supply to super organic standards, chemtrail conspiracy theories. The event includes a litany of speakers with conspiratorial ties and beliefs, from UFOs to a man who claimed that he was the original author of the Matrix movie, a claim that was rejected in court. Biasiucci and Fincham are not strangers to conspiracy conventions. In 2021, both spoke at a QAnon convention full of conspiracy theories and anti-Semitic propaganda. It is unclear what Fincham and Biasiucci are scheduled to speak about at Quantum Summit 2. Fincham has also fundraised with QAnon adherents and had major support from the QAnon community during his failed bid for statewide office in 2022. The event costs $432 for general admission, $185 for the gala dinner, and $532 for a VIP ticket. Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on February 25th. He'll sell you a Trump flag. He'll sell you a fuck Trump flag, too. Just before noon, on a Monday afternoon at the Arizona Capitol, Jeff Brown extends two long metal poles he keeps in a grocery cart. With his finger, the 60-year-old pops open the seal on a bit of plastic packaging and then unfurls the polyester flag it contained. As he runs it up one of the poles, the design becomes apparent. It's the United States flag, but upside down, historically used as a sign of distress. At the bottom, printed in black block lettering, it reads, "We are not okay." Despite its right-wing origins, it's a fitting flag for the crowd at the Capitol, which has been the site of protests nearly every day since Donald Trump was re-elected to the presidency. And for Brown, that's exactly the point. He's not here to yell and picket and chant, though he doesn't mind selling his wares to those who are. His booth, with flags of all colors and designs and political affiliations sprouting from poles 20 feet in the air, looking more like an art installation than a place of commerce, has something for everybody. He hoists a black flag that reads Mexico in brown lettering with a bird above it. Next, he strings up a Mexican flag, then a rainbow flag that reads Make America Gay Again, and a blue, white, and pink trans flag and the Mexican coat of arms in the middle. Another pole features a Black Lives Matter flag and a black flag that reads Fuck Trump in rainbow lettering. Brown designed that last one himself. Brown's flags go for $25, which he calls half off. He's not above haggling, though. Sometimes he sells flags for $19 or $20, depending on how much cash a customer has on hand. Tall and wearing a plaid blue flannel shirt and a straw cowboy hat, Brown has been seen at this location on recent Mondays as protesters have descended on the Capitol. He'll be there again whenever Arizonans want to exercise their right to public assembly. On other days, though, he'll be on the side of the Carefree Highway, where his flags on offer will look much different. There will be Make America Great Again flags, the Confederate flag, Arizona Cardinals flags, and even a Trump marijuana flag. Brown is in the flag hustling business, as he calls it, and a good flag hustler seeks a broad clientele. He sold flags at music festivals like Florence's Country Thunder, and was once arrested for selling flags outside of sporting events in the South. He's peddled flags at dozens of Trump rallies across the country, which has been really successful. He's also hoofed it to Washington, D.C. to sell flags at presidential inaugurations, including Trump's earlier this year. He was even at the January 6th insurrection, which Brown says was his biggest day in the flag business ever. Brown isn't particular about his customers. He's a true capitalist, he says. If they have something they want to say, he'd love to sell them a flag that says it. Some people don't have a big mouth like me, and they still want to say something, he says. And the flag is the way they can do that. Flag hustling. For Brown, flag hustling has been the family business for more than two decades. Brown grew up in Washington State, where he still spends part of the year. He used to own general stores in Washington and Oregon, selling a much more eclectic array of products. He stocked Christmas trees and pumpkins. He sold car speakers. Then, 23 years ago, a friend that Brown describes as a likable drunk flew a yellow "Don't Tread on Me" flag at his pumpkin patch. Brown bought one, and then began stocking them in his store. The flags were popular, and Brown saw an opportunity. He built relationships with wholesalers and bought flags wherever he could. Soon, he'd built up a wide catalog of flags and decided to make a change. He was going to go all in on the flag business. Business has been good. Brown sells the flags online at jbflags.com. He sells them in person and on the road, in his silver 1999 Ford pickup, which pulls a flag-filled trailer that many erroneously assume hauls horses. The business makes enough money to support myself and support my kids, all eight of them. Several of the Brown clan help him move product, and Brown says his daughter paid for law school by hustling flags at music festival. The key is not to limit your potential customer base. Most people, they can't get past their stuff. They'll only sell Trump flags, or they'll only sell military, or they only sell rainbow things, Brown says. I'm weird because I kind of personally agree with a lot. I respect it. We have differences. He'll sell you a pro-Trump flag and an anti-Trump flag. In fact, Trump flags, pro or anti, are Brown's hottest items. I have so many Trump flags, it'll blow your mind, and they'll all sell, Brown says. You either hate him or love him, and his flags saved the flag business. No pro-Trump flags are flying off the poles on this particular day. Other poor sellers, campaign flags for Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and George W. Bush, which are collecting dust in Brown's North Phoenix warehouse. This crowd, assembled for a No Kings on President's Day protest, carrying signs with anti-fascist slogans, is more of a fuck Trump mood. Marie Siegfried, a Chandler massage therapist, approaches Brown's stand at the No Kings on President's Day protest. She's interested in the rainbow fuck Trump flag flying above his cart. Brown rings her up. She declines the pole handle option for $10 extra, tapping Siegfried's card on his Square card reader. She'll be getting a charge from Rosie in Albuquerque, he tells her. Don't worry, he promises. That's his wife. Business isn't likely to slow down anytime soon. Protests, pro-immigration, pro-abortion, pro-LGBTQ rights, anti-Trump, you name it, are likely to continue at the Capitol. On the other side of the ledger, the MAGA faithful show few signs of losing faith. To Brown, they're all customers who could use a nice flag to help them speak their minds. If I'm not offending everybody equally, then I'm not doing it right, Brown says. And I mean that in a loving kind of way. The program continues now with this story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on February 27th. It's the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. 12 more of the worst politicians in Arizona history. Tribalism and Trump derangement syndrome can really skew folks' perspectives. Granted, in the Donald Trump era, the bar for what constitutes a contemptible politician is lower than a manhole cover. How quickly we forget that the vast majority of our elected office holders are self-serving egomaniacs who quite often get worse the longer they're in power. And for those who make politics a career, there is little hope of redemption. Short attention spans and presentism have us judging foggy memories of the past by current events, conveniently forgetting horrors gone by. Bad behavior and corruption are the rule in politics, not the exception. Once you accept this simple fact of existence, you will be forever on guard. Even with those polls who smile in your face, pat your back, and tell you what you want to hear. Last year, we brought you our list of the 12 worst politicians in Arizona history. But the Grand Canyon State boasts far more than just a dirty dozen. So we're back with another installment. These 12 may not have been awful enough to crack our original list, but each is bad in his or her own special way. Janet Napolitano. Ruthless self-advancement marked the political career of Napolitano, Arizona's 21st governor. She notoriously abandoned the state in 2009 to a nativist Republican majority in the legislature, and to her GOP successor as governor, Jan Brewer, for a plum position as Secretary of Homeland Security in the Obama administration. Brewer went on to sign the odious Papers, Please law, Senate Bill 1070, which led to a massive boycott of the state and spread fear throughout the Hispanic population. Though Napolitano had signed some anti-immigration legislation as governor, SB 1070 was universally opposed by Democrats, and Napolitano surely would have vetoed it. Should you be inclined to forgive her overwhelming ambition in this regard, keep in mind that during her tenure as Homeland Security Secretary, from 2009 to 2013, the department deported more than 3 million people. That exceeds the number of deportations in Trump's first presidency. Obama's regime ultimately deported more than 5 million people, earning Napolitano's jefe the moniker of Deporter-in-Chief. Nor should Arizonans forget Napolitano's years-long political alliance with Republican Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. In 1997, while Napolitano was U.S. Attorney for Arizona, the U.S. Department of Justice brought a complaint against Arpaio for the cruelty in his jails, which employed deadly restraint chairs used to suffocate prisoners to death. When Arpaio was forced to eat crow and sign an agreement with the feds to improve conditions, Napolitano did him a solid, appearing with him at a press conference to downplay the agreement as nothing more than a technicality, and a lawyer's paper. Arpaio returned the favor in 2002, crossing political lines to cut a TV ad defending Napolitano's record during her run for governor. In office, she helped Arpaio become part of the federal government's 287G program, which trains local law enforcement to act as immigration agents. Arpaio once had the largest 287G force in the nation, empowering his sweeps of Hispanic communities until Latino groups successfully pressured the Obama administration to strip Arpaio of that authority. John McCain, carpetbagger, warmonger, and ratfucker extraordinaire. The late Senator John McCain has been forgiven all sins by many Democrats for a couple of reasons. First, because Trump publicly excoriated the Vietnam vet as a loser and verbally attacked him on many occasions. Second, due to McCain's dramatic 2017 thumbs down vote to block the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Many conveniently forget that two other Republican senators also voted against the repeal. McCain just succeeded in hogging the credit. As for the logic that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, catch a clue. McCain was never your friend. He was a slimy political opportunist. Early in his political career, McCain took campaign contributions and free plane trips to the Bahamas from savings and loan swindler Charles Keating, and tried to protect the fraud king from government regulators, making McCain the most reprehensible of the Keating Five. The collapse of Keating's Lincoln savings and loan eventually cost taxpayers $3.4 billion to clean up. Nor was this a one-off. The sleazoids, kooks, and other questionable individuals McCain cozied up to over the years make quite the rogues gallery. Disgraced Pinal County Sheriff Paul Bebeau, Silicon Valley con artist Elizabeth Holmes, Tucson developer Don Diamond, vice presidential pick Sarah Palin, convicted bootlegger Jim Hensley, his father-in-law, one-time Arizona Republic publisher and stolen valedictorian Darrow J. Duke Tully, and more. Add these to McCain's list of sins: taking a $1 million donation from the murderous Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for his McCain Institute while carrying water for the country in the Senate, attempting to cover up his wife's theft of opioids from a nonprofit she ran, and retaliating against a whistleblower, and playing cheerleader in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, one of the many countries McCain has urged the United States to attack. St. McCain, please. Dennis DeConcini, the three-term senator and Democrat, is largely forgotten these days. That may be a good thing for him, though his name still pops up whenever anyone mentions the Keating Five scandal. Along with McCain, DeConcini went to bat for the infamous Flim Flam Man in two meetings in 1987, pressing government regulators to lay off Keating's doomed Lincoln savings and loan. Both meetings took place in DeConcini's Senate office. When the regulators warned the senators that a criminal referral was in the works for Keating, DeConcini kept working on Keating's behalf for almost another 2 years, according to a 1993 piece by New Times investigative reporter John Doherty. That same piece detailed how two of DeConcini's top aides did millions of dollars in deals with Keating, though DeConcini denied being aware of this. DeConcini reportedly accepted $81,000 from Keating and Keating's pals, but painted himself as a victim during Senate ethics hearings on the scandal. He never recovered as a result, choosing not to run for a fourth term in 1994. He was also accused of enriching himself while in office, purchasing land, along with other members of his family in 1979, that was in the path of the Central Arizona Project, and selling a portion of it to the government for a 540% gain. At the time, the senator claimed that he had no inside information on the CAP expansion. The Tucson Democrat was a bit of a Nepo baby, the son of Ivo DeConcini, an Arizona Attorney General and Arizona Supreme Court Justice. According to famed New Times political columnist Tom Fitzpatrick, Ivo was tight with mafia boss and Tucson transplant Joe Bonanno. The younger DeConcini did his best to downplay the connection, saying his family only knew Bonanno as a retired Wisconsin cheesemaker. Kirsten Sinema. Consider Sinema as the Erevist who failed miserably, and all because she had such open contempt for the voters who put her in office. The Green Party activist turned Democrat turned independent, ultimately went down to the crossroads and sold her political soul to Old Nick. All of it to end after 1 6-year term in the Senate. Sinema finally announced the inevitable in early 2024, that she was not running for re-election due to being near universally despised by the Arizona electorate. She claimed it was because I chose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done. And that's not what America wants right now. In reality, she went from leading protests against war and SB 1070 to voting against a $15 minimum wage with an insensitive, curtsied thumb down on the Senate floor. To supporters who took umbrage, she had a message, an Instagram shot of her sucking down sangria while flashing a fuck-off ring. She defended tax loopholes that benefited her billionaire backers and high-fived her fellow obstructionist, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And if she was not to the manor born, she definitely felt entitled to the luxury befitting her newfound stature. Sinema drew a Federal Elections Commission complaint over $180,000 in campaign expenditures before she'd announced she wasn't seeking re-election. Those expenses included luxury hotels, posh resorts, Michelin star restaurants, international travel, and winery visits. Even after leaving, she outspent all of her colleagues on security during her last 2 years in office to the tune of $1.7 million, which included $300 to suit up her security detail in Texas. Fife Symington. The political career of John Fife Symington III, great-grandson of Steel Baron Henry Clay Frick and Arizona's 19th governor, came to a cataclysmic end on September 5, 1997. That's when he resigned after being convicted on 7 felony counts involving bank and wire fraud for knowingly submitting false financial documents to 3 lenders. Symington was already tarnished by having to file for bankruptcy while in office, with a debt of over $24 million when his real estate investments tanked. In February 1998, a federal judge sentenced Symington to 30 months in prison, which the former governor avoided serving while his case was on appeal. A year later, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the convictions, finding that the lower court erred in dismissing a juror during deliberations. The feds seemed poised to go after him again, and Symington was reportedly ready to enter into a plea agreement to avoid trial, only for old pal Bill Clinton to pardon him before Clinton left the White House. The pardon was, apparently, payback for Symington having saved Clinton from drowning off the coast of Massachusetts in 1964. Tom Horn. Despite the sleaze and scandal of his one-term stint as Arizona Attorney General, in addition to his lifetime ban on involvement in the securities trade from the Securities and Exchange Commission, Horn somehow returned to his previous post as Superintendent of Public Instruction in 2022, with a win over Democratic incumbent Kathy Hoffman. Such is the benefit of sitting out a few cycles and relying on the short attention span of the public, which had forgotten all about his tawdry time as the state's top lawyer. Back then, the FBI investigated him, looking to nail him on alleged wire fraud, tampering with witnesses, and obstruction of justice. Alas, prosecutors never pursued charges, even though a brave whistleblower named Sarah Beatty came forward to detail how Horn had improperly used his office and staff to run for re-election. Perhaps most embarrassing for Horn was an incident that sprang from the FBI's investigation. While the FBI was tailing him, agents saw him commit an act of vehicular hit-and-run on a parked car. Horn was allegedly en route to an assignation with his mistress, whom he had hired for a job in his office. Of course. Horn was married at the time, earning him the unoriginal sobriquet Horn Dog. When Horn's wife passed, he married the mistress, so true love triumphed in the end. Accusations that Horn had improperly colluded with an independent expenditure committee hung over his head for years, as did the possibility of a $400,000 fine. But it ultimately came to naught, and Horn never had to pay penny one. Now, the 79-year-old oversees the state's public school system and is making a right mess of it, partnering with the right-wing nonprofit PragerU, nearly losing $29 million in grants from the U.S. Department of Education, which he thinks should be abolished, and making it easier for parents to exploit the ESA voucher system. The one good thing we can say about Horn is that he said he doesn't want ICE hunting for undocumented kids in Arizona schools. So kudos on that one, at least. Trent Franks. Two things sure to survive after a nuclear holocaust are cockroaches and reprobate politicians such as Franks. The former Republican congressman resigned in disgrace in 2017 after nearly seven terms as one of the most conservative members of the U.S. House of Representatives. Franks fell on his sword after the House Ethics Committee began investigating allegations that he had sexually harassed female staffers, including two he pressured to be his surrogate mothers for him and his wife. Franks even allegedly offered one staffer $5 million to carry his baby. Talk about an indecent proposal. Franks later admitted to discussing surrogacy with the woman, but claimed he never pressured anyone for sex. Franks could have afforded the $5 million, given his estimated net worth in 2017 of more than $30 million due to his connections to the oil and gas industry. Known for his anti-Muslim stances, as well as his perfervid opposition to abortion, Franks was also infamous for suggesting in 2010 that African Americans were better off under slavery than in modern America with Roe v. Wade. Last year, Trent joined a passel of other extremist nutjobs vying for retiring Representative Debbie Lesko's seat. He came in fourth in the primary, which might dissuade a normal person from ever running for office again. But no one's ever accused Trent Franks of being normal. Andy Biggs. To judge from his reception at the recent Arizona Republican Party convention, Biggs could be a shoo-in to win the GOP nomination for governor in 2026. State committee members enthusiastically cheered the uber-conservative five-term congressman when he announced his intention to take on Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs. They booed and hissed at the mere mention of his primary rival, multimillionaire gadfly Karen Taylor Robeson. Of course, Biggs has his own millions to draw on, 10 million to be exact, by virtue of his winning the Arizona Family Sweepstakes in 1993. Who said dumb luck doesn't count? The anti-abortion, anti-immigrant poll is backing a bill to deprive birthright citizenship to the children of undocumented immigrants. The Gilbert Republican also has been linked to the Stop the Steal effort to overturn the 2020 election, claiming that the winner of the presidential contest in Arizona that year was unknown. Duh, it was Joe Biden. He's denied allegations that he had anything to do with the planning of the January 6th rally that later devolved into an assault on the U.S. Capitol, falsely claiming that Antifa and Black Lives Matter were involved in the ruckus. Two of Biggs' brothers told the Arizona Republic that they believed that their sibling was at least partially to blame for the uprising. But this is likely only to bolster Biggs' standing with the MAGA faithful. Anthony Kern. The former state senator was and also ran in the same clown car congressional primary as Franks, coming in fifth with less than 5% of the vote. Ouch. But we've hardly seen the last of him. Kern is a former El Mirage code enforcement officer who got canned from the job for lying to his superior, earning a placement on the Maricopa County Attorney's Office's infamous Brady List of dishonest cops. While in the Arizona legislature, he backed an effort to allow law enforcement to challenge their inclusion on the list, only to have it watered down so it would not benefit him directly. Kern was indicted last year for his role in the fake elector scheme to overthrow the 2020 election, a matter that is still pending in the courts. And guess where he was on January 6, 2021? Yep, right smack dab in the middle of the MAGA crowd storming the Capitol. He's also known for his attacks on the LGBTQ plus community and for an unhinged 2024 episode in which he led a half dozen anti-abortion zealots in a prayer that involved speaking in tongues on the floor of the state Senate. That stunt won him New Times Award for Best Religious Nuttery. Not exactly the same as being on the Brady List, but close. Wendy Rogers. It takes quite a lot for Arizona's mega majority legislature to censure such a devoted Donald Trump follower as Rogers. But that's what happened in March 2022 when her fellow state senators voted 24-3 to censure her for conduct unbecoming a senator. Specifically, Rogers was reprimanded for encouraging violence during her remarks at a white nationalist conference where she reportedly called for high-level officials to swing from a newly built set of gallows. On social media, she also promised to personally destroy the career of any Republicans who went after her. Rogers has been blasted for repeating anti-Semitic tropes on social media, being a charter member of the anti-government Oath Keepers militia, and for suggesting that a 2022 mass shooting in Buffalo was a false flag operation carried out by the feds. She's denied the results of the 2020 election and blamed the January 6th insurrection on violent Antifa mobs. Last year, she celebrated wins by far-right parties in local German elections by posting the lyrics to an old Nazi fave, Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. She later claimed she had no truck with Nazis, though she happens to follow a few of them on X. It's been a long, strange political turn for the former Air Force pilot who began her political career as a rather wallflowerish Republican. But long as it works for her, there's no end in sight. Mark Fincham. Samuel Johnson said patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. But in Arizona, the shield for scallywags is legislative immunity, which Fincham recently invoked to get out of a speeding citation in Prescott. Like Rogers, the Republican state senator claimed to be a member of the Oath Keepers, though he later denied it, and he's been a purveyor of right-wing conspiracy theories. A fellow GOP legislator once referred to the cowboy hat wearing Fincham as one of the dumbest legislators. But brains are not needed to rise in the Arizona Republican Party these days. It's Trump-loving extremism that counts, and it got Fincham about 5 points away from becoming Arizona's Secretary of State in the 2022 election. As with Carrie Lake in her loss to Hobbs that year, Fincham sued, claiming shenanigans at the ballot box cost him the office by about 120,000 votes. A Maricopa County Superior Court judge later tossed Fincham's claims. Fincham also believes the 2020 election was stolen from Trump and, sigh, attended Trump's January 6th Stop the Steal rally, though he's tried to walk back his presence. He once claimed that the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which ended in violent melees and one death when a neo-Nazi plowed his car through a crowd of people, had deep state psyop written all over it. Jake Hoffman. Hoffman's got Fincham, his fellow Republican and state senator beat. Fincham used his legislative immunity to dodge a speeding ticket for going a mere 18 miles over the limit. But on January 22nd, the Arizona Highway Patrol clocked Hoffman doing 89 in a 65-mile-per-hour zone and declined to cite him, supposedly because Hoffman was recognized as a legislator. Hoffman's no piker when it comes to playing hooky, which is why he came in second as the legislator with the most excused absences from the session in 2024. He was also late 14 times. Was that why he was speeding? Hoffman is a blowhard and useless legislator who revels in performative stunts like his unconstitutional effort to ban satanic displays from government property, which was defeated on the Senate floor. His latest lunatic proposal is to create a bounty system for local law enforcement to round up undocumented immigrants, using a tax on wire transfers out of the United States. Predictably, Governor Hobbs has promised to veto it, again making the founding chair of the Arizona Freedom Caucus one of the least effective members of the legislature. Notably, Hoffman's company, Rally Forge, was banned from Facebook in 2020 for coordinated inauthentic behavior, basically creating fake accounts to push pro-Trump narratives. Hoffman is closely allied with Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA. In 2024, Hoffman was indicted by a state grand jury in Arizona's fake elector scheme, along with Kern and several others. Apparently, that's one charge to which legislative immunity does not apply. Rather, Hoffman has declared his innocence. He was subsequently elected to represent Arizona on the Republican National Committee. As we near the end of the program, let's take a look at one more story, this one written by Zach Buchanan, posted on February 25th. Mercury legend Diana Taurasi is retiring, and social media is abuzz. Phoenix Mercury legend Diana Taurasi is retiring from basketball, the 42-year-old told Time magazine in a piece that was published Tuesday. "Mentally and physically, I'm just full," Taurasi told the publication. "That's probably the best way I can describe it. I'm full, and I'm happy." Taurasi arguably belongs on the Mount Rushmore of Arizona sports, and she is an even bigger figure in women's basketball. She spent all 20 years of her career with the Mercury, which she helped lead to 3 WNBA titles. She retires as the league's all-time leading scorer, having made 14 all-WNBA teams and won 6 Olympic gold medals. Many consider her the WNBA's GOAT, the greatest of all time. Taurasi's retirement officially ends an era of Mercury basketball. She and Brittany Griner were bankable stars, and now both have moved on. Earlier this offseason, star center Brittany Griner, who returned to the team after spending more than a year in a Russian prison on trumped-up charges, signed a free agent deal with the Atlanta Dream. Here are some notable reactions to Taurasi's retirement. The story will be updated as more reactions come in. At WNBA. After 20 years of playing in the WNBA, Diana Taurasi is officially retiring. "Thank you, Diana, for changing the game forever. All of the accolades could never amount to the type of person and edge you've embodied when you stepped out there on the court. One of one." At Mayor Gallego. "For 20 seasons, at Diana Taurasi dominated the court, shattered records, and inspired kids to dream bigger with the at Phoenix Mercury. Her impact goes beyond trophies. She's changed the game and showed the world what's possible. Phoenix will always be proud of our GOAT." From former Suns player Eddie Johnson, at Jumpshot 8. "Wow, at Diana Taurasi. You and I know you've got a few more in you, but you have earned and own every ounce of this decision with high honor as the GOAT of women's basketball. Congrats, and may your next step be as great as your last." At Phoenix Mercury. Logo, noun. A symbol or other design adopted by an organization to identify its products, uniform, vehicles, etc. The logo is the greatest of all time in their field. Example, Diana Taurasi is the logo. From Suns and Mercury owner, Matt Ishbia. Congrats at Diana Taurasi on an amazing 20-year career in the WNBA. Diana is the ultimate leader and teammate, and her impact on our franchise, community, and the game of basketball has been incredible. Her name will forever be synonymous with the at Phoenix Mercury, and we're so grateful to have her as a big part of our family. And from former Phoenix Mercury player Sophie Cunningham, at Soph Haller. One of my favorite people. Legend. Love you, at Diana Taurasi. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawkrock.